Hello and welcome to D-Loot, the Melbourne Demons podcast. Nate, this is going to be the year, isn't it?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, our defence is so impenetrable and...
Except against Adelaide.
Well, yeah, okay, fine. But the way that we defended the corridor and the way that we just choked up the dogs so they had nowhere to move, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was incredible. It was a thing of beauty.
Harms'
role on Libba, Brayshaw's like excellent defensive acts,
yeah. Spargo's
pressure. I think so as well, yeah. And a real sort of selfless game, I must say. You know, Clary in the middle just keeps doing his thing.
Yeah.
You know, intercepts in the forward line, right? It was just beautiful. Every part of that game was beautiful. And watching the replay was a real joy.
Yeah, it really is something else. And some of our younger players, like Harrison Petty, who I know you were very skeptical of, Nate.
No, he had some good intercepting moments, didn't he?
He's really playing his role, you know. And Trent Rivers is unbelievable.
Well, so all these salty Essendon supporters are frustrated that Nick Cox didn't get the Rising Star nomination this week. Even though
Why
had
are you following
like,
Essendon supporters?
Oh, well, I just followed too many Twitter. I followed too many Twitter wars. But, you know, Nick Cox literally got 9 touches for the game. And anyway, he's a gun, though. But there's no doubt about it. But Trent Rivers has had such a great season and a half, to be honest. And this is just such great reward.
He's clearly played the best of that trio.
I think so. He's definitely been the most consistent
of that trio. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's just a superstar. He's so self-assured. His defensive actions are amazing. He's just the best.
Well, Sunitz, I wanted to draw your mind to one theory I have about the D's at the moment.
Okay.
And tell me what you think about it. So my theory is the biggest variable that will decide how we go in a game this year is who Max Gawn's opponent is, right? So let me give you some examples. Some of our weaker games this season have been against teams that haven't been that good, like North Melbourne, but who had a really good ruckman, right, in Goldstein. But so many of the other games, you know, where we've, I think, overperformed in some ways, has been with Gawn against these really young ruckmen, right? So in round one, Gawn was against it was against Fremantle, wasn't it?
It was.
God, what's his name? I can't even remember his name. That's the point.
It wasn't Sean Darcy is the point. It
wasn't Sean Darcy. Sean Darcy's understudy, right? Against GWS, he played against
Matthew Flynn.
Against St Kilda, he played, God knows, Sean McKernan.
What about against Richmond? He played against Dan Curvis.
Okay, maybe there's one hole in the theory.
I don't know, Kieran. I think that the problem is we're really good. And so there is no theory. It's just we're really good.
Yeah. No,
we win every week.
We're clearly amazing. I just think that's the only thing that can make a game close against us.
Interesting.
If Gawn has a really good matchup.
Let us know what you think about this theory from Kieran, guys.
Yeah, I didn't explain it very well. I explained it better the other day.
You did, actually, but that's all right.
I'll post some stuff and try and revive that theory. So this week we're going to do something a little bit different, because when a team just wins all the time and is perfect in every position, which is kind of where we're at, there's
literally
not that much to say.
What else is there to say aside from how good are the D's? I mean, in every facet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're very excited to have an interview with the Age chief sports writer, Greg Baum. And we're going to talk about some things that are a little bit more, how would you say it? A little more philosophical.
Oh, it's right up Kieran's alley. It's like this is straight out of the Greg Baum, Bob Murphy, Louis Robertson, if you're listening, textbook.
Right. You can hear people already turning off their podcast.
No.
But we're going to talk about, you know, football journalism, how it's changed. We're going to talk about what it means to be a Melbourne supporter and the weird identity crisis many people are having right now, including myself, about this team. And whether this is the best Melbourne team that has existed in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Which Greg Baum is very qualified to talk about. So it's a pretty exciting episode.
It's a very exciting episode.
And forgive me for all the gushing. I love Greg Baum. I think he's an amazing writer.
There's a lot of sycophancy in this episode. So I just wanted to give you all forewarning.
Yeah. But before we go, Neats, the Brisbane game.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a giant
huge
stadium.
Yes. Thank God it's not going to be at the Gabba, because that was a little bit of a concern.
It is meant to be in Alice Springs, I thought.
Right. But, you know, I thought that maybe Queensland might successfully appeal the Brisbane Lions might successfully appeal the Queensland government to have it there. But, or the AFL rather. But, huge game. I think we'll win.
You think so?
Yeah. I think we'll win pretty comfortably, maybe 25, 30 points.
Right. I think you could make an argument that it's the best defense in the league against the best attack right now.
I'd say so. Right. Yeah. I mean,
so it's going to be a
what they did to GWS last week was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they've been insane form, but I just don't know if teams are going to be able to break us down.
No. You
know?
I mean,
like, especially when we're on, which we have been most weeks with the exception of against Adelaide and North Melbourne.
Definitely. You know? And look, I could not believe that Jake Lever is having the best intercept season ever by a player, ever. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, we're really well set up for it. It's going to be a cracker. Is Lucky Neal coming back?
That's the question. I think he's going to get through training and then they'll see. But that would be hopefully not.
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute cracker. So we will come back with a full recap of that game next week. But until then, here's Greg Bourne. Go Deez.
Go Deez.
Greg Bourne, welcome to the Deluded Podcast.
Thanks for having me from wherever you are and wherever I am.
I think we know where you are, Greg. Unfortunately, the answer is locked down in Melbourne right now, right?
It is, yes, but I'm not complaining. I have a comfortable life compared with most, so onwards.
Greg, I have to start by telling you a little bit of a secret about Kieran. Kieran was desperate to become a sports journalist at the Age. He was basically reaching out to... Applied for the cadetship, was sending sort of fairly, sucky-uppy emails to the various sports journalists.
To Jake Nile, and probably to you at some point.
No, I think definitely to Greg at some point.
Okay.
Yes. So this is, quite a moment for him, I think. Yeah.
Oh, well, hopefully, however far or however little progress you made, it was all a stepping stone because a long time ago I was asked by a young lawyer to put some advice on how to get into newspapers. I had a cup of coffee with him and he was very keen to get to the Age and perhaps work in the sports section or elsewhere in the paper. Anyway, we went off in a different direction, but his name is Wally Darling. So I like to feel that I sort of helped give him his, 1% of his little shove to where he is now. So don't give up.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that's another person I've aspired to be and haven't become. So really, it's the duo now.
You also sent him some sucky-uppy emails as well. There's a real theme going on. There's some real overlap.
But enough about me. Greg, we want to know, so we absolutely love your writings. We think you can really communicate the kind of the beauty and the joy of sport in a very special way. When did you first fall in love with football?
Oh, with football. My first memory is a very vague one of the 1966 grand final, believe it or not. I was 6 years old, and it led me down the garden path because I was at the home of an uncle who was a St Kilda supporter, and of course he was delighted beyond all telling that day and was making that obvious. And six-year-old me, knowing nothing of the previous 100 years or so VFL history as it was then, felt sorry for this team that could lose a grand final by a point. So it turned me into a Collingwood supporter for the least likely reason that anyone could have to be a Collingwood supporter, and that's been my cross to bear. A lesser cross perhaps than being a Melbourne supporter through that period, but a cross anyway. And then I played a little bit in primary school and secondary school, not much beyond school, and just lived a very Melbourne life, which had football quite near to the heart of it.
So does that mean that you had an affinity for the kind of the losing team or the kind of unpredictable team to support?
Well, I think, there's a little bit in all of us that warms to the underdog. But at six, of course, I didn't know that this underdog was, in fact, a bit of a bastard that everyone hated. But I've stuck and you would, as Melbourne supporters, you would understand about how difficult sticking can be at times. But it's almost a characteristic of following footy in Melbourne, the people do stick. I know in other codes, in other parts of the country and the world, it's not uncommon to change allegiances and barrack for three or four different clubs in your lifetime. But it's certainly true of rugby league in Sydney, whereas in Melbourne it's very much a thing that whoever you first choose or were chosen by, that's who you are for life.
So, Greg, you are a beautiful writer, obviously, and I must say that I remember this article you wrote after the tragic death of Phil Hughes, and it was sort of about, how death prompts this sort of self-reflection. And it was honestly, it's still like, I still remember it to these days because the words were so hauntingly beautiful. I guess I'm wondering, when you have this writing talent, why did you decide to apply that talent to sports as opposed to some other field?
It was just a convergence at a particular time in my life. I'd always enjoyed writing. Obviously, English was my strongest subject at school, and I enjoyed creative writing particularly. And I was a teenage boy who loved sport. And so I didn't set off in journalism with the intention of being a sports writer. I just wanted to be the best journalist I could be. Fairly early on in my career, I realised that there was this convergence of two things that were really special to me, or two things I really enjoyed in life. And then a little while after that, I became aware of a great tradition of good writing about sport, particularly in England. I knew less about American sports writing at that time, but I learned about the great tradition of, exceptional writing about sport in England. And so all those threads sort of wound themselves around each other and set me on a path which I've never left, mostly don't regret that.
So, Greg, these days journalism and football journalism as well seems to have changed quite a lot. You don't see all that many writers writing really reflective, thoughtful pieces about sport. There seems to be a real premium on newness and controversy and tension and, Do you agree with that assessment, or is that just some kind of nostalgia for a past that never existed?
No, I agree with that. It's certainly changed. We all tend to be nostalgic, but it has changed. There's probably two factors to that. One is when I first followed footy, and even when I first began working in the field, the electronic media coverage wasn't anything like it is today. There might have been there was no live telecast of footy. There was this feeling that if you telecast it live, that would take away from the gate. So there were only replays, and there weren't many of those, and they weren't full replays. There might be a quarter of one match and a quarter of another, and that was about it. So the centrepiece of sports writing at that time in Melbourne was the Match Report, and that did lend itself to creative writing at times. I mean, factual writing as well, but there was a scope to be creative. Well, there's pretty much no call for Match Reports now, because anyone who's remotely interested watches the match themselves, either goes or watches it live through any number of means now. I mean, you're in Mexico City, but I'm sure you watch every Melbourne match live because you can. So there's not a great need to tell people what happened. So then out of that grew this need for secondary and tertiary ways of covering sport. And then as a corollary to that, electronic media made everything 24 hours a day. It meant there was no deadlines as such. The deadline was as early as you could get a story in or get a piece written. And so there's always been a daily deadline, but it's even more stringent than that now. And so the time to actually write a piece that you might be proud of is a good deal more restricted than it used to be.
So do you think, given all of that and the pressure to do things so much more quickly, do you think you would enter the field now if you were starting out again?
It's a good question. Probably not, no, because my first what attracted me to sports writing was the chance to write. It was sort of my creative English class from school parlayed into a profession. It was great. But that, as I was just saying, that opportunity is much scarcer than it used to be. So I'd think more about it now, knowing what I know now and having seen the evolution or the devolution. I would think twice about it.
One more question about journalism before we turn to the D's. I'm kind of interested in your your craft, how you go about writing these articles. Because, of course, so many sporting games fall into a script, right? And you see the same thing happen a million times again and again. Where do you go to for inspiration? How do you find something new to write about, 36 guys running at each other on a field?
I wish I had a clear answer to that question. I've pondered it from time to time, but it's really quite organic. I mean, I guess, one abiding rule in the back of my mind always is, well, what's different about this contest? What's different about this story? What's something that sets it apart from other matches in this round or other matches in a given year? So you're probably looking for that at some level the whole time, and then trying to find a context and an answer to that question. But then beyond that, as I said, it's organic. It's just that for all the patterned way in which footy is played now, no two matches are exactly alike, and no two individual contests are exactly alike, and so there should be in that a chance always to be a little bit original in what you say. It's not quite that easy, of course, but that's sort of that's the thinking that's going on in the back of my mind most of the time.
On originality, does it frustrate you that these days players and coaches are so media trained that to within an inch of their lives that it's completely impossible really to get an original or much less inspirational idea or thought or from anybody in football media these days?
Oh, it absolutely frustrates me. There are more, I think this is probably true of politics as well, that there are more media journalists, so-called journalists, working in what the sort of loosely termed anti-media than there are in media. So people working to massage and control the message that comes from, certainly that's true in politics, but it's also true in sport. I mean, AFL media has many, many more people working for them than we do, and probably than the whole of the Age, Herald Sun and Australian together collectively have working on AFL. So it is very controlled, and that is a frustration. You can take that back to basics, though, this idea that we must hear at length from the coach and all the players over and over through about a given match or through a week is what it has changed in my lifetime. I remember originally when I first became aware, as I said before, of say great English sports writing, they didn't deign to run reams of quotes from, as you say, often quite banal or trite quotes from coaches or players. They just wrote about the match. And if they spoke to anyone at all, it was to clarify something that had happened during the game or clarify a tactic that had been used during the game. And that was about it. And then it evolved to this process now where often it's only the players and the coaches we hear about. So it's a frustration, but it also, if you can sort of rise above that, it still leaves plenty of opportunity.
So then where do you sit, I suppose, on the controversy surrounding Naomi Osaka's decision to, to avoid doing press conferences? And, obviously she cited a lot of mental health concerns. Do you think that more and more players should be given opportunities to do written conferences or written interviews as opposed to verbal ones to avoid some of the pressure and sort of, claustrophobic nature of some of those conferences? Or what do you think should happen in those instances?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Tennis is unique in that a player is contractually obliged to do a press conference after every match. Obviously in a tournament, that's hopefully after a series of wins and then eventually a loss. And also if you're a good enough player to get to the end of a major tournament, a 2-week tournament, then you're doing extra press conferences as well. I just think it's too much. I think they're being asked to do too much, and that's no good for them. It's no good for media because everything becomes repetitious and quite shallow. Naomi Osaka, says, and you can see that she's an introvert, so she doesn't find it easy. So the idea of putting herself through this, it's a fairly grueling process every second day for her whole career, virtually. And I say grueling, sometimes it's because she's having to explain a defeat, which, sooner or later happens to everyone in a tennis tournament. But I think some of it is dealing with this sort of overwhelming banality of the whole thing. So I think the solution is to do less. I saw a suggestion yesterday that maybe a player fronts up two or three times throughout the course of a tournament, if they're lucky enough, good enough to stay in a tournament for that long. But not every match, it's impossible for anything good to come out of something that's as repeated as that. So I have some sympathy with her position, or quite a bit of sympathy with her position.
Mm.
Greg, turning to Melbourne now, I suppose you've been working in sports journalism for 4 decades or so. Do you think this is the best Melbourne team you've seen in that time?
Yeah, I think it is. You see a lot of false dawns, and I'm sure you can tell me much more about those than I can. But they just they look. Well, I thought for some time, I thought going back to 2018, which was also a good year until they hit the buffers in Perth in that preliminary final, I thought then they had pretty close to the most talented list in the competition. Then it went awry for a year, as tends to happen at Melbourne. But again, going into this year, I thought that just for sheer manpower and talent in each part of the field that they've got the competition covered. So at some point that had to click, and it feels like that's what's happening right now. Of course, there are no guarantees that come with that. The most talented list doesn't always win the premiership. In fact, quite often doesn't. There are so many more other factors involved. But this looks like the best chance to me. I think of the two grand finals that Melbourne have played since they last won a premiership. They're good on them for getting to those grand finals, but they were long odds underdogs in both those games, and they turned out that way very much. So I don't have to remind you, I'm sure. Whereas this feels like a team that if it finishes in the top four, and it really should from where it is now, it should be, well, that they, as we sit and talk here now, they should be and are the premiership favourites.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been very interesting for me as a supporter is seeing a team that's better against the good teams than the bad teams, and better defensively than offensively. I don't think I've seen that, in all the time I've been supporting. And it feels like a premiership profile in some ways, right?
Yeah, well, the wins against the ones I remember, the win against Richmond, obviously, Richmond are the benchmark of the time, so that automatically is a tick of a box. And I particularly like the win over Geelong. I know Geelong were a little undermanned that day, but we're living through a year where every team's has been undermanned at some stage. I just thought that was the sort of game that a Melbourne team of old would have lost, and instead they bossed that game and won it convincingly. So from that point onwards, I thought, this is the team to watch out for this year.
Greg, you wrote a beautiful piece recently about the emotional turmoil that Melbourne supporters are feeling as they finally have a team that might be able to win the premiership after so many false dawns. Can you tell us a little bit more about that piece for people who haven't read it?
Well, I've cheated a little in that all the people I quoted in it are people I know personally. I've known enough Melbourne supporters over many years to know what they've lived through. I have to say, and without hopefully causing any offence, that I've never particularly warmed to Melbourne, even as an underdog, through through my time in footy.
We've never always worn Collingwood, so it's mutual. Yeah.
Wait, can I? Sorry, I just have to follow up on that. Yeah. Wait, you've never worn to Melbourne despite the Neild era, but despite the tanking crisis, despite the sort of board crises, despite the sort of just decades and decades of unbridled sadness?
There always seemed to be an even more either pitiable cause or a more deserving underdog somewhere along the way. It was Fitzroy before they became Brisbane, and then it was the Bulldogs, and the Bulldogs premiership remains the most fantastic story I've covered in terms of premiership winning teams. So there always seemed to be somewhere else, and also I guess. And running contrary to the spirit of that story, in the back of my head, there's always been the impression of Melbourne as the club of the MCC, which every non-Melbourne supporter in Melbourne, has that image in their head. And look, I've been around long enough, and I know enough Melbourne supporters to know that's just not true. I mean, Melbourne has as diverse a profile of supporters as any other club, and none of the people I spoke to for that story would fit the classic MCC, fair weather, smoker stand supporter image of a Melbourne supporter at all. But I guess footy is an irrational game, so somewhere in the back of mine, not mine, that was always blocking my empathy valve, I suppose. But I really, at the moment, I guess. Yeah, partly because they're playing such attractive footy as well as winning footy. You do warm to them, and then out of that, I began to feel renewed warmth for these people I know who've devoted their lives to barracking futilely for Melbourne and now have this chance. But I can also sense their apprehension. How high do you dare get your hopes, knowing everything that's gone before? And of course, I wrote that story. That story appeared on the morning of the Adelaide game. So that night, I got furious text messages from all three people quoted in that story saying, "Look, see, you've done it. Don't ever come to us again and talk to us about Melbourne, the premiership favourite. It's all over." But I think they rectified that with their win over the Bulldogs last week. So it was. Yeah, the story was meant to just convey, and every club that gets to the top of the ladder, I guess, feels it to some extent. But Melbourne, particularly, the sense of if I touch it, is it going to break? From this point, we've been near to this point before, and we don't dare quite believe yet, and we don't want to believe in yet. Look at them; there they are at the top.
I have to admit, I've had a slightly different identity crisis, which maybe points to something dark and twisted in my soul. But I think it's so central to my identity over the years to have supported a bad team, a team that always disappoints, that part of me feels a bit conflicted this year. And maybe this is going to get the Dealer podcast some hate mail, but it's strange, right?
It's going to get some hate mail from me, actually, but anyway.
But you're not used to a team that doesn't disappoint, that's consistently good. That's Hawthorn, that's Geelong. And when it becomes Melbourne, it almost feels like we're watching a totally different entity.
I will say, there is something, and you identified it in your article, but there's something about the sporadic win, like the joy of a sporadic, totally unpredicted win, right?
Mark Neild era win.
Yeah, like when we randomly win over Essendon, which in the most unlikeliest of circumstances, when we beat Hawthorn for the first time at the MCG, right? A team which has like terrorized us, all of a sudden we beat Geelong. Like it just down at the Cattery. These wins were so few and far between that you really relished them, You weren't sort of lathered with good feelings at all times. You were sort of like, you actually had to really work for them. And I don't know, it is a strange emotion right now to have constant elation.
Yeah, well, they're mini premierships, aren't they? When you're not expected to win anything and then you win one, it's a mini premiership. Whereas when you're on top and you're expected to win every week, the emotional wrench does change. I can well imagine that. I've lived through that.
Yeah, I should probably check myself into a psychologist before the end of this year.
Oh, don't do that.
Sorry, last question from us, Greg. So there's this classic kind of debate in football, and I suppose most sports, where people can move teams between the purists, between the Bob Murphys of the world, and the people who say that football is a business ultimately, and we shouldn't expect loyalty from players because they don't get loyalty from clubs and so on. Interested to get your take on that debate. Where do you see that?
I've always looked at loyalty. There's three different levels of loyalty and purity in the construct of a football club, in my mind. So there's the players whose loyalty has to be conditional, because they don't know how long they're going to last. If you're really, really good, you might be there 10 or 12 years. On average, you're only going to be there 4 years. So their loyalty has to be to the people they're with at that time. I understand that. And I understand that some give a lot more of themselves than that. And Bob Murphy was one who decided once he was, I guess the other element of that is they don't choose the club chooses them. You know, and most players aren't followers of their club until they arrive at their club. So, and some play their careers out that way, but Bob Murphy was one who decided, well, they've picked me, so I'm going to pick them, and they're going to become my club. And that's been, you know, pretty much the core of his existence ever since. Then the club's loyalty is to winning, but also to sustaining the business. So that also has to have a semi-pragmatic thread to it, which probably doesn't always gel with what the fans think. And the fans' loyalty is the most pure and the most long-lasting and the most idealistic and the most unrealistic. That's why we love footy, because we have the license to be all those things at once. And then all the spin-offs that come from that, the great highs and the great lows. So I understand that the business aspect of it. In fact, you know, it's unavoidable. You know, these clubs are up to $100 million a year turnover enterprises now. So I understand it. I just choose not to dwell on it.
So do you think that Melbourne owes something to someone like Nathan Jones?
Yeah, I do. But I'd hate to be the one having to sort of fit that very noble sentiment into an every week match plan and team plan, especially with the talent they have there now. Maybe the injury sub gives them an opportunity to sort of play through that, because he's been, I mean, I don't know if I tell you guys what a servant he's been, what a warrior he's been. How low, how deep were the bad times as he played through, and he seemed to be pretty much the only player you had that was trying. So I think they owe him to get as, you know, as many games into him this year as they can, and get him to that club record. And I think with 23 players available in any given game, that there must be a way of accommodating that. But like I said, I'm just glad it's not me that has to work out how to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Greg, thank you so much for joining the Doolittle podcast. It's been a real honour.
Thank you also. And I should add that, part of this renewed primal root discovered warmth towards Melbourne grows from the fact that I have a grandson, whose mother you know, there's a tussle going on between her and her partner, my son, for the ultimate loyalty of that little boy, Gus, and it just so happens that his first year on Earth coincides with the best year Melbourne have had for, you know, maybe 60 years. So my son feels like he's losing that battle at the moment, and I have to be prepared for the fact that if he does, and if we lose that battle, then I've got to be, I love Gus to bits, so I've got to love his football team too.
Oh.
That's extremely noble of you. I would not be that generous. Yeah. I would shun Gus at that point, personally.
Thank you as well.